Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. We're calling this conversation AKA God, as we tend to have some difficulty simply saying the word God without some caveats. What do we mean when we say God? As we look at the Judeo-Christian scriptures, how is it approached? Well, that is exactly what Greg Meyer is going to dive right into. Enjoy.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you all here. I've got some rather uncomfortable news for you all, and that is that you are all wrong. You think you know who God is, or you think you know who God isn't, and you don't. It's true about me, too. I'm in that same camp. And I guess the positive side of that, maybe somewhat uncomfortable news, is that, you know, it's okay. It's okay not to have this who God is or God isn't all figured out, to have it all right, unless you are pretty sure you've got it all. No, hold it. I can say that, right? It's okay if you have this God stuff all wrong, unless you think you've got this God stuff all right, in which case I think we're in a fair amount of danger. Anyway, I'm Greg Meyer. It's good to have you with us, whether you're here on podcast or live stream or sitting with us in this room. We're glad to have you here. We are going to be spending the next couple of weeks wrapping our heads and our hearts, because yes, this is a heart thing as well. We're going to be spending that kind of wrestling with what is this, which is also known as God, aka God. And I think it's an important journey for all of us. You may have heard me say this before, but when I meet new people who obviously don't know me yet, and they find out I'm a pastor, they quite often feel obliged to tell me that they don't believe in God. To which my typical response to them is, well, tell me about this God that you don't believe in, because chances are I don't believe in it either. The truth is that the God that most of us believe in or don't believe in probably wasn't worth believing in the first place. In fact, the God that most contemporary society kind of bandies around is more a social construct that's been created over the last couple of centuries by what society would really like God to be, rather than our deepest learnings and experiences and our sensations and our reflections would actually try to show us. In fact, I would say that most of our ideas about God have little more biblical basis than the Easter Bunny, which I know is a little harsh to the Easter Bunny, but that's what it is. I mean, the thing is, you know, to go back on this, having some sort of misguided and naive ideas about what God is isn't the problem so much. What the problem is, what we get into trouble is we think they're adequate. And we need to realize that the way we understand God, the way we think about God, is not adequate. But we're not going to be spending a lot of time these weeks critiquing the way people talk about God and the way we think about God. I mean, that's not really helpful. What we want to do is to try to open up some new territory so that we can better imagine and talk about that which is also known as God, aka God, right? And as we get into this conversation, there's one thing that I think is important to have clear in our minds, and that is the difference between prescribing something and describing something, all right? When I describe something, I'm doing exactly that. I'm telling you what I see and understand something to be, and you can take that and look and you can decide for yourself, right? When I prescribe something, what that word means is that I am saying authoritatively not only that that is what I think it is like, but that is actually what it is like. I'm making the claim that I am actually saying what it is. Now, not everyone in the church and theological world agrees with me on this, but to me it's obvious that our thinking and our talking about God is always descriptive. It cannot be prescriptive. It doesn't have the ability to do that. We are describing what we experience, what we think of, what we understand about God in this whole God thing. We have absolutely no ability to say this is what God is like. Why? Well, to put it bluntly, because whatever God is too big for our minds, for our language, for our imaginations. For me to authoritatively say God is this would be similar to like a cell in my liver telling a cell in my skin, this is what Greg is. I mean, one, I don't think it has a perspective, and two, I don't think it has ability to communicate it. It's pretty similar for us. But that doesn't mean that that liver or that skin cell aren't intrinsically part of who I am, or that I am not incomplete without them, right? So that's some important stuff to have and keep in our minds as we talk about that. But this fact that we can't fully know who God is or what God is isn't a bad thing. In fact, I'd say it's really good. I mean, seriously, do you want whatever it is that is holding the universe together, whatever, what is, you know, the fabric of the existence sort of depends on it, and it is the truth behind all that. Do you want it to be something that you or I could capture in a paragraph or work out in a spreadsheet or present in PowerPoint? I don't think so. I think we want God to be out of our league. It's something that we're intrinsically part of so that we can sense it, we can participate with it. It isn't foreign to us, but we do it as humble learners. We don't do it as equals. I wouldn't trust, frankly, a world that I could fully grasp and understand. I mean, I can't really even make it through my daily schedule without missing a thing or two. I mean, do you want me running the world or understanding how the whole world works? I don't think so. And sorry to say it, I don't want you doing it either. And I think that's probably pretty mutual for all of us. Okay, so one last footnote, and we'll dive into the Bible and how the Bible begins to help us understand God. And that is that these 3 weeks are meant to give us better language and better understandings, maybe even a posture towards God. And partly because, as I already said, the word God is not only inadequate to what God is, but it's also greatly compromised. I mean, people hear us hear that word spoken and just have already decided that this is dumb. I mean, they know, they have heard, people have heard the way that typical churchgoers talk about, think about God, and they've already dismissed it. So there's not even a hearing. It's just automatically lost and cut off. My guess is that that is familiar to a lot of you. You both experienced it, and maybe there's a part of you. Maybe that is why you are here, because you couldn't handle the way that you heard God talked about a lot of ways. So this understanding of God is both inadequate and it is compromised. In fact, when we try to talk about God here, you've heard us stumble around. You've heard me stumble around trying to talk about God and that which is in and above and beyond and between and beneath. I mean, we just trip ourselves trying to say something that begins to be adequate and that could actually not be a barrier to the listener. And one of the big things that we have used is our own metaphor of the three strands, right? The one that is ourselves, the one that is the others, all others, not just people, but all things, all others, and then the one that is this third strand, the one that is AKA God, right? The one that is bigger than all those things. And somehow the weaving of those together seems to make sense. It's a useful metaphor for us, and it fits well with our name, Fabric, Life Woven Deeply, right? It seems to make a lot of sense. So during these 3 weeks, I mean, I've done this in the past, but during these 3 weeks, I'm not going to talk about God that much. I mean, sometimes I'll use the word God. Sometimes I'll talk about the third strand. Sometimes I'm going to say Yahweh or I am who I am or just I am. And here's the reason for those, I am who I am and I am, because those then are where we dip our toes into the Bible trying to blow our minds with this whole idea that we also know as, and inadequately know as, God, all right? And that's really the big reason, another big reason for a rethinking of God, right? That it's inadequate, it's compromised, it's also inaccurate. Those three letters and how we typically sum it up, it is really a misreading and inaccurate way of understanding what the Bible is trying to show us about God. On your outlines there, which you do have on the back of your Sunday paper, there's also a link on the podcast, but there's a box there for you to write in. What are some words that describe to you, that maybe open up how you understand this that is also known as God? So feel free to just pop those in there whenever they come to your mind, okay? So the word God, G-O-D, it actually doesn't come from the Bible. It's early Germanic language from long, long ago, has a completely different sort of derivation, and it actually isn't a name. It's a title. It's a sort of a type of thing that is being described. In Hebrew, which is the language that the Old Testament of our Bible was written in, the word that we translate as God is Elohim. Elohim, right? And that appears already in the first verse of the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, Genesis. In the beginning, God, Elohim, created the heavens and the earth, right? Now, that is the title. That's what you call that kind of thing. That's what the Bible called that kind of thing, Elohim, right? We say God. The name of that God isn't revealed until the next book of the Bible, the book of Exodus, which Exodus means the road out. It's the accounting of Israel, the Hebrew people, as they escape slavery in Egypt and they go on the road out through the wilderness. You'll recognize some of these themes, the wilderness journey, and they spend 40 years on that journey. Okay, and anyway, so this is, we look at this, and because it is pivotal to how the Bible is trying to help us make sure that we have this understanding as we begin to talk about God, right? So that's why we want to look at this. Now, during this time, Moses, who is going to be the leader in their escape as they are fleeing Egypt, right? Moses is, at this point, out in the wilderness, okay, again, and he's a shepherd. He's got a flock of sheep, and he's going through the wilderness, and he sees something really strange. He sees a fire in the distance he starts going towards, and you can see it's a bush, and the bush is burning. But what's really weird is that the bush is burning, but it never burns up. It just keeps burning and not getting consumed. So he goes close to it, and as he approaches it, well, let me read from the story. Elohim, God, called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then Elohim said, "Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." Elohim then said, "I am the God, Elohim, of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Now, most of you, anyway, took your shoes off when you came in here, because this is holy ground just like that was. I mean, frankly, it's always holy ground. Why do you take your shoes off in these moments? When these times when you are recognizing who God, Elohim, really is, and you are being drawn into that, you don't want to be removed from it. You want to be closer to it. Immediately, God with you. Take your shoes off. The ground is holy. Have nothing between your feet and the ground. The thought, the idea, the experiment is holy. You want nothing between you and it. You want to let down those barriers. You want to open up those doors. There is another reason for having you taking your shoes off when you came in today, and that is the strike has been going on for about 3 weeks, and these floors will never be this clean again, right? So we just thought we'd take advantage of that. Hey, and I think the strike is over. All right. Then, okay, so that's just happening, and then the Lord says, "I've observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings." And then Elohim says to Moses, he wants Moses to lead the people out of Egypt into their promised land. And the story goes on like this. But Moses says to God, "If I come to the Israelites and I say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is God's name?' What shall I say to them?" And God says to Moses, "I am who I am." In Hebrew, that is Yahweh. I am who I am. God said further, "Thus you shall say to the Israelites, 'I am has sent me to you.'" Now, if I was Moses, I'd be a little ticked off right now. Come, like, can't you give me a real name? I mean, all those other gods, they got cool names. What is this, "I am who I am"? They're going to think like I'm just doing some weird doublespeak or something like that. But God's name, God's saying, "My name is Yahweh. My name is I am who I am," which is not really a name. I mean, it is sort of, but it's sort of a non-name name. I mean, it's a name for something that can't be named, right? I mean, like, it just simply is. There's a certain undefinableness in I am who I am. And it also reminds us that there aren't various ways or things God can be. God is what God is. There's just no choice. I mean, it's just self-defined. Whatever would be that which is also known as God simply is that. We don't get to choose. God doesn't get to choose. It simply is. No choice. Now, the Hebrew people, for the thousands of years since that story was brought into who they became as a people, have felt and treasured the holiness of that name. It was a sacred and awesome and therefore awful, full of awe sort of name. It's like looking too directly into the sun or getting too close to the fire. It is something that you are careful with and know that it is more powerful than you can probably handle on your own. And so they were very careful to not ever speak that name aloud. Now, that's even true today in a lot of traditional Orthodox Judaism. So this name, Yahweh, in Hebrew is spelled Yod, He, Vav, He, four letters, simply known as the Tetragrammaton, right? I mean, you may have heard of that. If you watch Indiana Jones movies, you've heard about the Tetragrammaton, all right? And you don't dare speak it. Now, the reason you don't dare speak it isn't because if you do, something bad is going to happen to you, but because of the awe of what it represents, the humility before what it was, how it symbolizes, to use our language, the fabric of existence, or heaven and earth, as they often refer to it. Now, to avoid saying Yahweh, I am who I am, when they were reading the Bible in Hebrew, what they did is they always would substitute the word Adonai, which is simply a word in Hebrew that is a term of respect. It's like saying sir or master or my lord. It probably typically translated my lord, but small l, not big L, right? Just my lord. And that way they would always get around doing that. Now, scholars later didn't know they were doing that. We just saw that they had Adonai in there, and so that's what they took. And so when the New Testament, which is written in Greek, they got to Yahweh, I am who I am, and they just wrote Kurios, which is their Greek equivalent of a term of respect. And then the English translators came along, and we saw that, and we translated it to our own version. We call it the Lord. You know, what's a Lord? Lords and ladies, right? It's another term of respect. But the big thing is, it's a title, isn't it? Master, sir, Lord, those are titles. What was Yahweh? Yahweh said, no, this is who I am. This is my name. It's not my title. That's I am who I am. I want you to be stuck in that uncomfortable, I can't figure out what that means and what it's all about, and that's how you know me, and that's who I become to you. So there's, as long as we're talking about words, there's one more word, and this is the word ineffable. And no, ineffable doesn't mean a class that nobody could fail. I suppose there's another meaning that ineffable could... No, we won't go there. Okay, but what ineffable is referring to is something that is incomprehensible, and therefore, it cannot be summed up in words. There's no way that it could be uttered. It is too big for us. And to me, the Lord misses the ineffability of the nature of I am who I am by a long ways. In fact, it turns it into something that we can handle. The name Yahweh, I am who I am, was meant to remind us that what it is referring to is beyond our comprehension, beyond our language. I am is not packageable and is not manageable. But by golly, we've done it to it. We've tried to put God somewhere we could handle God. Okay, there's a lot more about one word in the Hebrew Old Testament that you might want to know. But it's important because it's there not to be a detail or to simply inform us that this is what God's name is, and you want to know that. I mean, after all, God never seems to wear a name tag. But it's to remind us that we don't and we cannot think big enough about God, and we need a constant reminder of that to us. Now, that message just continues on and on through the Bible in about every way you can imagine. I'm sure you all know the Ten Commandments, right? We'll recite them now. Anyway, but in the introduction to it, there's one line that you might recognize, that you shall make no graven images, right? That means you shouldn't carve any idols, any statues. You shouldn't paint anything. You shouldn't try to draw anything about God. And again, Orthodox Jews still stick to that. And the reason isn't that if you do, you're in trouble. Like, you know, Yahweh's going to smite you or something like that. No, just that, well, yeah, that is exactly is Zeus. That's thinking of that kind of a God, right? That punishes you for doing the wrong thing and rewards you for doing the right thing. It's just that while that picture, while that that statue might represent something important about God, about I am who I am, it also boxes that in. It also contains it. It also limits it. In fact, these ancient people saw so many of the gods of the cultures all around them being used simply for the agendas and the hopes and the dreams of what those people wanted and use them against their enemies that they didn't want their god to be able to be any have any part in all of that. So that's a lot of what's going on with that for them. So as they do that, we also see the same message coming across in the very beginning of the Bible and the story of the creation in the book of Genesis. There we are told that humankind is created in the image of God. Now we've talked about this numerous times. It doesn't mean that we look like God, but it means that there is something in what God is that we are also part of. We are aligned with whatever God is, or at least we have the potential to be aligned with that. When we package I am who I am and make God a convenient ally of our positions, our preferences, of our agendas, which we are so want to do, we are turning that all around, and suddenly, instead of us being made in the image of God, we are making God in the image of us, right? In fact, maybe that is why that line is in the first chapter of the Bible. Knowing our penchant for turning God into something that we want God to be, it's said very clearly that we are made in God's image, which means God wasn't made in ours. That quick reminder. Okay, Jacob. You know, for every story that seems to maybe make God a little bit more like easy to understand and packaged and nice and neat and tidy and all that stuff, there's another one that will blow that out of the water. Like when Jacob wrestles with God at the River Jabbok. Melissa talked about this just a couple of weeks ago. There, Jacob is starting this wrestling match, and it's with a man, an Ish, some sort of being. We're kind of not real clear. That's a little murky. And as he wrestles on, suddenly then it's an angel or some sort of divine being that he's wrestling with, a spirit of some sort. And then by the time you get to the end of the wrestling match, it's God, clearly God that he is wrestling with. Could he not tell the difference? Or is the person telling the story just not being consistent? Or is there a message that God is always there? That when we look deeply enough into any of our wrestlings, when we take off our shoes and live in holy ground, we find that everything is a portal for being in the presence of God and wrestling with God. Then there is all these other examples. You have a million times where the ordinary gets turned into the extraordinary. Over and over again, we find people just speaking to God, right? People speaking, or God speaking to people. But we never really get an exact description of how it works or what that's like. It just tells us the word of God was coming to. When we do, it tends to be more like what Jacob had with this Ish become angel, become God, or Abraham, Balaam had same sort of confused wonderings, not being sure exactly what is going on. Or it happens in a dream, like Joseph, Samuel, and others. Or it's a messenger, an angelos, an angel, representing I am, here, gone. Was it really happening? Can I convince anyone else of it? All gets kind of weird and messy. And often we're just simply told in the word of God of I am who I am came to Noah, to Abraham, to Moses, to Joseph, to David, the prophets, and to others. And the point of all that isn't that God is some sort of shapeshifter that shows up sometimes and doesn't, or you can't really tell what God's going to look like, or that God speaks to some people and not to others, and probably doesn't do it so much anymore, did it a lot back then and not anymore. The point, I think, is that there are these people among us. There are these times in our own lives. We know these people today. You know these people. You know these times in your own life where you are attuned to, where you are in sync with something about the world so that you have those moments of clairvoyance. You have those glimpses of what really matters, what really makes sense, what you really should do, how the world really is put together. And you can't quite put your hands on it, and your language is never quite able to capture it. But by golly, you got to try, don't you? You do. For those people in the Old Testament, it's just like it is for us today. It's an act of faith, not of knowledge or certainty, to take what we heard, what we saw, what we experienced, and understand it as the word of the presence of I am who I am. like Elijah, the prophet who sought to speak the word of God to the people during his time, hundreds and hundreds of years before the time of Jesus. He got a lot of trouble with it, with Queen Jezebel. He had to flee to save his own life. He's running, ends up on the top of Mount Horeb, goes, hides in a cave there to try to save his own life. And while he's in this cave, then finally, the word of God comes to him. The word of Yahweh comes to him. He's been waiting a long time. He's like, why isn't Yahweh helping me? I'm doing Yahweh's work, and I'm in trouble because of that. Shouldn't Yahweh be showing up, rescuing me from all these problems? And this voice says, go out on the mountain. So he leaves the cave, and he goes out on the mountain. And suddenly, there is a wind, a great wind, it says. It's shattering boulders. It's breaking the mountain. And it says, but Yahweh, I am who I am, was not in the wind. And then after that, there was an earthquake, and the mountain shook, and things broke apart more, and Elijah doesn't know what to do with it all, but he realizes, and God was not in the earthquake. And then a fire comes and burns up the top of the mountain, destroying everything, powerful, mighty. But again, Yahweh was not, I am who I am, was not in the fire. What's up? I mean, all the ways an all-powerful God is supposed to show up, where is God? But then after the fire, the story tells us that there was a kol damama daka. Hard to translate verse. It says something like a sound of silence, a voice, still small voice, still silent voice. The opposite of the grand, the loud, the brash, in-your-face, supersized superhero God that we often expect, that we think should be showing up. Now, isn't that how we experience that third strand? A voice that is speaking but can't really be heard, but we know it. We'd like the billboard, right? A loud, clear announcement, some certainty, something obvious laid out for us, and the other people could see it too so they don't think we're crazy. But I am who I am is not apart from the world. That all of a sudden, I am would show up and be apparent, but is there all the time. And it isn't for I am to become obvious so that we can see Yahweh, but it is for us to be quieted, to look past the distractions so that we could see the God that is there the whole time for us anyway. One last example, Ezekiel, who lived 600 years before Jesus, when Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, had been destroyed by the Babylonians, or everyone had been taken off into captivity. And Ezekiel had visions that looked like he had eaten a few too many funny mushrooms, to put it mildly. I mean, seriously, they're totally bizarre. Just go read the first three chapters of Ezekiel sometime. If you're familiar at all with the book of Revelation, which is the last book of the Bible written like 100 years after the time of Jesus, you're going to see a lot of similarities, a lot of the same motifs, symbolism, and ways of speaking are there. Obviously, you kind of know where the book of Revelation got it from, right? And anyway, so Ezekiel has an experience of God, of I am who I am, and goes into great details about it. And let me read a couple of verses here. As I looked, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually. And in the middle of the fire, something like gleaming amber. In the middle of it was something like four living creatures. This was their appearance. They were of human form. Each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Now, Ezekiel is just getting warmed up, okay? And it goes on and on and on. And gradually, he gets to seeing something like a human form. It's seated on something like a throne that is above something like a dome that is above something like four living creatures. Let me read on. And seated above the likeness of a throne was something that seemed like a human form. Upward from what appeared like the loins, I saw something like gleaming amber, something that looked like fire enclosed all around. And downward from what looked like the loins, I saw something that looked like fire. There was a splendor all around, like the bow in a cloud on a rainy day, that was the appearance of the splendor all around. This was the appearance of, the likeness of, the glory of I am who I am. When I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of someone speaking. Interesting side note, the thing that the voice says to him is, what are you doing here? But same message that Elijah got, by the way. So now why Elijah wrote like this, what he experienced, what he was trying to convey, one is kind of largely lost to us. He was using symbolism that the people of his name, of his day, understood. We don't really quite know what it's all about. And we don't really know maybe how later editors enhanced all this. You know, I don't know, but frankly, that isn't the point, at least not for our purposes here today. What is important is that, one, he is using symbolism and metaphor that is clearly not meant to be taken literally, but for what it is pointing at. Like I said, the symbolism that he was speaking was stuff that people in his day would understand. I mean, they kind of knew what these allusions were referring to, and so they could put these pieces together. They could put two and two together. That's one thing. The other thing is that he is going out of his way to make sure that what he is describing is not understood as literally what God is about or what God is like, right? He's going out of his way to say that everything was something like and something like, I mean, painfully repeating that not exactness of it over and over in every detail. And then when he finally gets to describing what this thing that was something like a human form, that is Yahweh, I am who I am, he uses a triple distancing of his language from the thing itself. This was the appearance of, the likeness of, the glory of, I am who I am. That's kind of like saying, I saw its shadow reflected in the mirror while I was looking through the curtain. Or, I know it because my barber's second cousin's friend said so. You know, whenever you triple distance something like that, it gets kind of fuzzy. And that isn't by accident. He wants us to know that we don't quite know. We can't comprehend what it is that he is trying to talk about, where he is trying to lead us. Ezekiel is bending over backwards to get us out of our comfort zones in imagining I am who I am, and therefore also be open to reimagining our relationship with I am who I am. So, keep open. Be ready to be surprised. Be careful about whipping out our language about God or the Lord. They aren't wrong, but they're mere shadows of the reflection of what you saw through a veil darkly. The goal isn't to have God all figured out, but to continue to learn what God might be. That's a little bit bigger than it was before. And the difference between those, having God all figured out and continuing to discover what I am who I am could be for you, is the difference between having a God that is freeing, a God that is connecting you with all things, or a God that is really saddling you with obligations and the right way and the wrong way of doing things and ultimately separating you from a world through your certainty of what God is supposed to be like from the rest of the world that you were intended to be part of. Okay, so that was a crash course in the depiction of the third strand. I am who I am from the Bible. You don't need to remember that all. What I hope you take away is a sense that God was never meant to fit into those three letters, G-O-D. As Paul wrote in to the community that's trying to figure out who Jesus was, as someone who was a clear window, perhaps, to God as a human being, he said, my prayer, what I would hope for you would be that you would somehow have the power to begin to comprehend the breadth and the length, the height and the depth of Christ's love, so that in doing so, you might be filled with the fullness of God. Filled with the fullness of God, that you might begin to just grasp what this is all about. So, one more thing to add on to this, and that is this believing business, right? I think we got to get there. Believing in God, believing in Jesus, however you want to think about it. After all, that is what it comes down to, like I say. And I know, You know, we have this idea that there is a right way to believe, or we're told at least that there's a right way to believe and the right things to believe in. And for a lot of you, I know that's a difficult situation, maybe with your families, where there is that expectation. Or maybe it's your past self and growing up in a world that was much more rigid, and you knew that, or you were told that if you didn't believe the right way and the right things, you were left out of approval of that community, maybe left out of the community, maybe told you were left out of heaven. Here's how I understand all this, and you can agree with me or not. I'm not trying to get you to agree, but I do want you to think deeply about these things, and I want you to talk about them. I want to share your ideas. I want you to do that with your groups, with your family, your friends, okay? So here it is. God, the third strand, I am, does not want you to believe in him or her or it or whatever that is, okay? You see, in this 21st century, believing has sort of become an intellectual exercise. It's something that we check off. When I say I believe in something, you're pretty much saying I affirm that that is true. So the question, if the question is, does God exist? I check the box, yes, I believe God exists. Now, I don't think that's what God's really interested in. In the languages of the Bible, Hebrew in the Old Testament, Greek in the New Testament, they have one word for what we have three words for. We talk about faith, we talk about trust, we talk about believing. In those languages, there's only one word. Now, faith and trust and belief kind of mean the same thing, right? I believe in something means that I have faith in it, and therefore I trust in it, right? But we use them differently, and the way that we use them differently makes a lot of difference. Words matter. To believe in something being true is an intellectual exercise, but to trust something, that's different. That doesn't mean I just agree to it. That means I'm going to commit to it. It means it's going to have a claim on my life. It means it's going to direct what I do and how I do things. Not just acknowledge them. I'm going to rely on it, even depend on that which I trust. God doesn't want you to believe. God, the fabric of the universe, I am who I am, wants you to trust. Not because you're supposed to, and if you don't, you're going to be in trouble with this God, but because that which is also known as God is the meaning of our world. It's what's behind it all. And to trust in something other than that is to be cut off from what this world really is all about and how it really works. So my goal here these weeks is not to get you to not say God anymore, okay? That's not what we're talking about. But to help us all set God free from that name for our own sakes, because I think we need a bigger vision of it for ourselves, and also because it's a stumbling block for a lot of other people who need some sort of connection with that which is a lot bigger than any of us. And they're not going to have it as long as we can't find a way to inspire and connect with them. So I invite you to start that right now. In this barefoot moment, just relax in your chairs. Let those stockinged feet touch the floor, wiggle your toes. Know that you are there. Imagine you are Moses, having slipped off your sandals to apprehensively approach something that you don't understand, but that intends to change your life. I don't know what it is that you trust or that you say you don't believe, but let it go. Try not being so sure. I'm not asking you to put something else in its place. I'm just asking you to consider that there is more. Something surprising. Something perhaps simpler and more beautiful than you ever imagined before. Imagine that your comprehension, your understanding, your language around God is a world that you can be standing in right now. And you look around and you see the fixtures of it, the words, the symbols, the places, the times that you have grown to expect that which is also known as God. And then notice across from you in the room, there's a door. A door to what is beyond. So in your bare feet, you walk over and you take the handle and you begin to open the door, but you don't open it yet. That there's time for what is beyond that door later. Right now, just envision the smile on your face and your eyes that are clenched shut. You're just peering out through a little bit because the brightness is going to be too much. So you squint those eyes and prepare to glimpse the breadth and the length and the height and the depth of its love. Thank you. Thank you. You can come back now. There aren't a lot of communities that are willing to kind of just blow up and let go of God and start from scratch with it. I'm really thankful and proud of you guys that we can do that together. I think it's one of the most important things to be if we're trying to be church and not just have one that we go to.
Thanks for listening. We hope this podcast sparks conversation in other parts of your life. If you're looking for meaningful connections, there's a Fabric group for you to try, whether you're in the Twin Cities or not. Tag @FabricMPLS with your wanderings on social media and find resources on our website, fabricmpls.com.